Law Focus Podcast. Bringing you the facts, handing you your rights. This is Law Focus.
Good evening and welcome to another edition of Law Focus. My name is Millicent Ndiweni and I am together with my colleague attorney.
I'm Tsepo Mohapi.
And together we will be your voice of law for the evening right here on VAR FM 88.1. Now, in South Africa and in many other states in the world, the general rule is that you are innocent until proven guilty.
That's right, yeah.
But there are times when it seems to be the other way around, where people are suggested to be guilty until proven innocent. And that is essentially what leads to what we call wrongful convictions.
Yeah, well, not quite. I can see how people might see it that way. The position is always that you're innocent until proven guilty. But once you are convicted, you are guilty. And then you have to go through the process of either proving that the court erred via an appeal or a review, whether the process was incorrect or whether there's some point of law which the court got incorrect. But the burden of proof is never shifted away from the state. The state must always prove that you're guilty and you're innocent until they prove that you're guilty.
And I can imagine that if you are the person who finds themselves in the situation where you are falsely accused, you honestly would feel that the state is just doing you an injustice with all these burdens of proof that now you have to try and show that I am actually 100% innocent. I never committed this crime, and yet here I am in jail, 10 years of my life down the drain.
Yeah, I mean, it will be very, very frustrating for you. But like I say, you know, if you're going through the court system, there's the appeal, there's the review process. But it is an expensive process, a very expensive, a long process. And if you are truly innocent and you have been convicted, that is something that, you know, is completely life-altering.
Yeah, that is so true. I mean, we're going to have to speak to an expert, Mr. Innocent Mtembu from Legal Aid, and he's going to explain to us how it is even possible that courts can come to a conclusion where they find someone who is innocent to have been guilty of a crime they did not commit. Yes. And then Ms. Simonia Mashangwani from the Vits Justice Project. This is an organization that has a lot of work that they do with these people who have been wrongfully convicted, and she's going to basically share with us from a first-hand experience working with such persons. I think it's going to be a very interesting conversation and very informative hearing her input on this matter.
Yeah, it should be very interesting to see from a legal point of view how this happens, and once it does happen, what people like the Vits Justice Project do to try and correct the situation. But of course, this wouldn't be a conversation without your input. And if you want to join the conversation, you can send us a tweet on @VARFM using the hashtag LawFocus. Remember that you're tuned into LawFocus on VARFM 88.1. So I want you to stay tuned for the upcoming discussion as we tackle the realities and the challenges of wrongful convictions. But before we get into that, let's take a look at the stories that have been making the news this week in our legal hotspots.
Rounding up all the top stories of the week, is Legal Hotspots.
And it's the world of entertainment and music with Babes Wodumo and Mampinja. Charges of assault have been withdrawn against Mampinja following a alternative dispute resolution mechanism which kicked in between Babes Wodumo and Mampinja. Interestingly, both of them failed to appear in court on the 9th of July, and the matter was then finalized on the 12th of July. I remember that the magistrate was extremely irritated at both of them not appearing on the 9th of July. It's important to note that, you know, alternative dispute resolution is a method legitimate method of dealing with matters. And once that process has been completed to the satisfaction of the courts, the NPA, perhaps the social work, whoever it is that's involved, the matter can be withdrawn. It's usually not withdrawn by the complainant. It's usually withdrawn by the NPA in a sort of agreement with the complainant themselves.
So. I wonder if that is sufficient, though, that the alternative dispute resolution should be enough to deal with resolving a domestic violence matter, because that is essentially a criminal matter. It is assault. It is violence.
I mean, you make a good point, but I mean, our law does have dispute resolution, mediation, all of that available to it to try and resolve issues that do not really have to be concluded in court. But of course, in a domestic violence situation, you have to be very careful because the individuals are in a relationship, a domestic relationship, whether it's cohabiting or they're in a romantic relationship, and things could flare up again. So the alternative dispute resolution has to be tailored towards the individual reforming their behavior, especially in a domestic violence situation.
Absolutely, because it would be terrible to see it happening again after such means were taken to try and make sure that it actually does not ever erupt. But in our other story, do you remember the Black First, Land First movement?
Yes, the man with the very, very, very difficult surname.
Andile Mtama. I don't know if I got it right, the pronunciation, but... So they were a political party, one of the small parties that organized before the 8 May elections this year.
Which were abysmal, if I remember, for them. They didn't get one single seat.
After they were so sure that they were going to parliament, right?
Shame.
And the Freedom Front Plus actually had a matter to take to the Electoral Commission against them to say that the BLF should not be registered as a political party because, according to Section 16... subsection 1C of the Electoral Commission Act, it prohibits any discrimination of any political party to have people join as members on the basis of race, ethnic origin or color. And that's exactly what the BLF does. So if you are not black, you cannot join the BLF movement. And that is where the problem is.
Yeah. I mean, this is could be a devastating ruling for them. Although perhaps not, because they didn't do well in the elections. So as a political party, they're not doing well at all anyway. But I mean, as a social movement or whatever it is they want to be, they may still be a viable option, for those who really do want to highlight their blackness.
Activism of land.
Yeah, and all of that.
Yeah.
But so, as a political party, Shem, it looks like it's over.
Yes.
For the time being, anyway, they'll have to reform in order to comply with the electoral code.
Mm.
Yeah. But, I mean, we'll see what happens
What happens. Yeah. Well, we've got the Zumas in the case in this evening.
Yes, the Zuma family is again making news over the last week.
They're everywhere.
Yeah, they are. Tutuzane Zuma was found not guilty of culpable homicide and reckless and negligent driving. He was found not guilty by the Randburg Magistrate Court on Friday. That's the 12th July. This involved a matter where he was in a car accident in 2014 that involved a taxi and his Porsche, and a passenger died. Her name was Pumzile Dube. She was killed as a result of the accident. It also looks as though the NPA will not be appealing the matter, given the judgment of acquittal there. To be honest with you, I am not surprised at this. I'm really not.
Tell us why.
His defense was, I know people criticize his defense a lot, but his defense was fairly solid. People were doubtful of it, but it was reasonably possibly true. And I think that the magistrate, whether we like him or not, like his father or not, made a good decision. I've personally aquaplaned on 3 occasions. Only one of them was serious, where I lost control of the car totally. And on none of the occasions was I speeding. None of them resulted in a collision, but one of them was on the freeway and I spun right around. So I know what it is to aquaplane, and it's that easy.
Mm.
Yeah.
Shame. Unfortunately, the lady lost out on possibly getting an out-of-court settlement, where she would have gotten an reasonable amount of compensation. Of course, life can never be brought back.
Yeah.
But the family could have that as an option, which they can't have anymore because...
Well, there's nothing to prevent them from still approaching him.
Unless it's the road accident fund, yes?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the road accident fund, that's still a possibility. That should be underway already. It's independent from the criminal case. But there can still be some sort of maybe mediation, I don't know, between the parties. Remember, mediation is still available, even in a claim like this.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, in our final legal hotspot story for this week, which is probably the hottest story, making headlines everywhere in South Africa, and I'm sure somewhere in the world as well, Zuma is back at the Zondo Commission of Inquiry. So the state capture inquiry is essentially trying to unravel the happenings of corruption within the state over the past 9 years. There's been many, many allegations, and Zuma is basically put up there to be the mastermind of state capture, and that is why he is now brought to answer some questions. And so far, there's been a lot of drama. There's been denials and
accusations.
Yesterday he was name dropping apartheid spies. Today he was telling us that he has death threats against him.
Yes, and his family.
So it's going to be an interesting one to watch right up until Friday.
Now, having watched, you know, a little bit of it, you know, it's difficult because it's during working hours, but having watched a little bit of it, I have a newfound respect for how cunning Mr. Zuma truly can be. He's managed to testify for 2 days, and in those 2 days, all we've been discussing are spy allegations and conspiracy allegations and character assassination situations, rather than what he's actually there for.
Yeah, because you guys are out there to get him. Why?
I mean, he's out there to answer charges relating to state capture, fraud, corruption. That's what he's out there to do. None of us are discussing that. And he's done a very good job at diverting our attention away from what we should be discussing and actually discussing things which seem to be pie in the sky.
Well, what we should be discussing right now is wrongful convictions. And remember, you can tweet us on @VowFM using the hashtag LawFocus. Up next is a very interesting conversation we're going to be having with Mr. Innocent Mthembu from Legal Aid.
Rounding up all the top stories of the week. It's Legal Hotspots. LawFocus on Valfang 88.1. Point of information.
Good evening, Mr. Innocent Mthembu. Welcome to LawFocus this evening.
Hello, good evening. How are you?
We are very well. Thank you for joining us on our show. Let's get right into it. You work at Legal Aid South Africa. Can you share quickly what it is that you do there and how you find yourself involved in matters relating to wrongful convictions?
I am an advocate at the Legal Aid Board, Legal Aid South Africa, and I've been there for the past 14, 15 years. That I represent people who are accused of having committed the offences, mostly rape, murders, and all things, robberies.
Right.
Mm.
And how would you sum up what wrongful convictions are?
The wrongful conviction is when the person is accused of having done something wrongfully. But it can arise in different things, in different ways. Either someone is accused wrongfully, and then people are so convincing that they sound real, or as the story is true, of what had taken place. That's number one. Number two, it could be the presiding officer just basically misdirected himself on facts or on law.
Mm.
In such a way that he can make a mistake and then arrive at the wrong, basically, decision, which will basically be a conviction.
Right. Now, Mr. Mthembu, tell me, how common do you think wrongful convictions are? And what sort of factors can lead to a wrongful conviction? For example, is perjury a big deal, you know, part of it, or is it forensic evidence which is not correctly presented? What is going on where we have wrongful convictions, and how common are they?
most of the times it will take place either intentionally or not. But you have instances whereby you come across an accused person having done a confession.
Having done a confession. All right, yes.
Having confessed in the case or in the commission of the offense.
Mm.
And then when you find that maybe the police officers who are basically alive to the facts, and then they will beat the person up to the point where he confesses. And then you will never know, basically. That's number one. Number two, you'll find that in the case of Peja, just as you have said, and then it is common, it does happen.
Right. Okay. Mm. So people will embellish their testimony to make it better for the prosecution.
That's correct. You see,
you can say it like that. Okay. Now, if I sort of look right, I practice a little bit of criminal law, and I will arrive there at court. I'm just giving you an example quick. I'll arrive there at court, and me, I will only have one or two matters there at a time, right? Because I'm working in the private sector. And then I'll arrive, and there will be a legal aid attorney there who is now forced to deal with a dozen or more matters on one day. How much of a factor is that in contributing to a wrongful conviction, where you almost feel as though they're inundated?
That one is a serious factor.
Mm.
Is a serious factor.
Mm.
I haven't worked in the magistrate court, but I know for a fact, either through the complaints or else the reports from the inmates, or else when I'm reading the transcript, you'll see that there's a complaint that my attorney came to court with 15, 20, 30 files, and he or she didn't have time to consult with me.
Yes, they consult in court sometimes.
Consult in court sometimes because of the pressure. And also with the perception that out there, some of the officers or presiding officers, they have a perception that we are part and parcel of the state. So now we have to be roped in, and even if we don't have time,
yes,
we did not prepare timely.
Yes.
That does happen, basically.
Okay.
Mm. I mean, I'm going to ask a bit of perhaps a contradictory question. I don't know. And the reason I ask is because according to the United States National Registry of Exonerations, race is a huge factor of wrongful convictions there in the U.S. Does the same happen in South Africa? Is race politics a big factor in some of these convictions?
Politics is not that a factor, but there are several cases and cases that basically have come to court in South Africa, whereby politics will see that it is basically an element, and it is a role that is played in the matter being in court. See, that's number one. But it doesn't happen too much. Two, with regard to the system that is used in America and here in South Africa, are two different systems. So then there may be a problem with them, but the systems are two different that are being used in court.
Right. I see. Now,
yes.
Now, you know, if you are convicted, you will often perhaps have the option of going to a superior court, right? But you have limited grounds on which to appear in that superior, whether it's the High Court or the Supreme Court of Appeal or the Constitution. You'll have very limited grounds on which to either appeal or review. Are those mechanisms enough to curb wrongful convictions or not?
I'll say yes or no, but basically on the first part is there are two scenarios.
Yeah.
whereby the regional court has convicted and sentenced an accused person to life imprisonment, there is an automatic right to appeal.
Right, okay.
So therefore, they don't have to apply, they don't have to convince that court that has convicted the person that I have good grounds that another court may come to another conclusion.
Right, okay.
But then that the what you're asking comes into a field to play when the sentence in the regional court, in the lower court, is below life imprisonment.
Right, yes.
And then when you go to the higher court, whereby basically the sentence, any sentence, but the beginning is where you, where you have to begin, is to convince this court that has convicted you that another court faced with the same facts, but sitting in a different forum, may come to a different conclusion. But the problem part of it is, at times you find out that our presiding officers, they become emotionally involved in the matter. And as they will use anger, others they will convict with anger and sentence with anger. Others will feel you are just you are not that you are embarrassing them, but you, when you say this, you presiding officer, you made a mistake, you act, you misrepresented yourself. They will feel as if you are attacking them
on a personal level. You mean
on the personal level?
Yeah. Okay.
And now that someone is sitting with a wrongful conviction, what avenues do they have against the state? What measures can they take? What options are there for them?
You mean after they've been acquitted?
After they have been convicted.
After they've been convicted, as I'm talking, there's an appeal, there's a review. But it depends on appeal.
And if they are acquitted?
It depends. When you deal with appeal, you deal with the fact of the case and the law applicable in the case. When you are dealing with the review, you are dealing with the conduct of the presiding officer.
Okay. And if they are acquitted?
If ever they are acquitted, they have to, if ever they are, for instance, they decide to sue the state. When you decide to sue the state, you have to allege that this was a wrongful conviction, this was a wrongful prosecution or malicious prosecution, wrongful arrest and malicious prosecution, and then when you get acquitted, and then you begin to say that the state had this type of evidence, and this evidence, no court or no one would have basically put this case into court. Basically, they need to have a prima facie case against the accused person. And at times, they bring the case without that prima facie case. So now, when you sue the state, this is a recourse. When you are suing the state, that is when you are acquitted before the conviction. When it comes to judgment, you are acquitted. You have to basically sue for a wrongful arrest and malicious prosecution. But you need to allege that there was no prima facie case.
Yeah.
Okay. You see? Right. But if ever you get convicted and then sentenced and then you go via the appeal, the same thing that can take place, you have to say that court, it didn't have anything to convict me. It was just basically convinced by me or it was wrong. Somehow, depending on how the judgment is framed on the upper court, and then you can sue the four
of us. Good, okay. Now, if I make a distinction between a wrongful arrest and a wrongful conviction. Now, a wrongful arrest is fairly easy to determine. You sort of determine whether an arrest was necessary in this instance, and then to be incarcerated, say, for 24 hours or 48 hours, whatever it was you incarcerated for, was that necessary? And then you can sue on that basis. Now, a conviction is a far more involved case because you would be arrested, you would be put on trial, you'd go through the whole bail process, everything, go through pleading and then through trial and then through sentencing. Would you say it's easier, or how hard is it to get compensated for that whole long process, because there must be many role players in a wrongful conviction suit, whereas in a wrongful arrest suit, it could be restricted just to the police station and the actual police officer who arrested you. How difficult is it to actually get justice for a wrongful conviction?
The wrongful conviction is very difficult.
Okay.
Because this trial of facts, there has to have been evidence that is led, and there's a trial of facts, there's a an analyzer of facts and everything.
Mm.
So now you have to put up a stronger case.
Right.
Basically, the upper court must have found that at the beginning, that's from the beginning, you were convicted wrongly, and it is an injustice that took place. But in that case, it is very difficult.
Okay.
Because the only thing that the state has to prove, there was a prima facie case, there was evidence, there was something.
There was something to go to trial.
There was something to go to trial.
Yeah, okay.
Now, it sounds like a very interesting conversation. Is there ever any counseling or other types of assistance offered to people who are eventually acquitted?
Absolutely, there's none that I know of. I should think that I think that NGOs, and because not only the after conviction, but NGOs and other role players should basically come into this picture. But the person stays there 10 years, 5 years, and then when he's acquitted on appeal, he just goes home.
Sure.
There's nothing. Just recently, I think a month or two ago, I've had a guy who has been in custody about 5 years, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
He was just acquitted on appeal. He's just at home, and there's no rehabilitation, and then there's nothing he can do, and he doesn't have anything now. He has to start afresh, looking for jobs and all those things, which can become a strainer, basically.
Yeah, definitely. That's shocking. Hopefully we can try and work towards improving some of these systems within the justice industry. I think much can be done to ensure that, especially where the state is the one that has wronged civilians, there's something that actually is done to make sure that there is repairing of, your humanity.
Yes.
Definitely. Thank you so much for joining us on the line. That was Mr. Innocent Mthembu from Legal Aid South Africa. He is an advocate, and he basically just helped us unpack some of these very important issues right here on Law Focus. Thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Yeah, well, I think a really big distinction is when you are accused of a crime, in order for the court or the prosecution to take you to trial, they don't need to believe that you're guilty. And that's really important. All they need to believe is that you have a case to answer to. And that's it. And that may result, if the evidence that they lead, that may result in your conviction, even if you are innocent. And you may be, okay, let's say you get off at a later stage. Can you sue the state like Mr. Mthembu now says? But you'd have to prove that there is something so wrong with the state's case that they could and should never have convicted you, which is a tall order, very tall order.
Well, right on that point, we asked you exactly about that in your opinion question tonight. Do you believe that suing the state is a good way of dealing with wrongful convictions?
Good day. I'm a postgrad student in the humanities faculty. Definitely, I do believe that the state should be sued for wrongful convictions, and they should be held accountable, and it should set a good example of how we want to see things being done moving forward.
With regards to this, my opinion is that, firstly, morally is a good idea, but we have to remember that morals and law do not mix. And in addition to that, we have to pay attention to the fact that the judges are part of the state. So in a way, that would be contradictory, and it might not be possible for this case to happen, bruh. I don't think it's a good idea.
I disagree with the state must be sued for wrongful convictions, because the state sends a decision based on the evidence they get. So, for example, ngazikwaza ngqedwe uThabo. Ngasu uThabo, so yeah.
Yes, in speaking to Kabelo, from what I see is that I would sue the state with dealing with the wrongful convictions. If I were to be convicted for something that I didn't do, then they find out 8 years later that I wasn't the criminal they were looking for, I would definitely sue the state. And I'll get a soundful lawyer, a soundful legal advisor. That's what I meant.
I mean, because it's state. No maganjani ngizomose ngizofuna imali mina ibili ngizothi I clean my name just like that.
Good evening, everybody. So if I was wrongfully convicted, would I actually sue the state? Yes, indeed, I would, because I believe that so many other prisoners can attest to this. They come out of jail and there's almost nothing left for them. There's so much reputational damage that has been caused. And so some form of compensation needs to make up for what I've been through and what I've sort of lost. So yes, I definitely would sue the state. And I guess it is a good way of dealing with wrongful convictions.
Interesting one, isn't that? Reputational damage is huge. So if the money is going to help to at least better the situation, why not? After all, it's really hard to find a job when you come from jail, is it not?
Almost impossible in this country to find a job, even if you're an accused who hasn't been convicted yet. You just have a pending case.
Mm.
But, you know, this one question perhaps that I would just put out there is, so you are a magistrate or you're a judge, evidence is presented before you, which you have an accused, the prosecution arrives and says, but this is the evidence you have against this person, to present its case, and then the accused is also allowed to present his case. Remember, in South Africa, we do have free representation if you can't afford representation, although it's problematic sometimes. And based on the evidence, the magistrate says, on the evidence presented before me, or the judge, on the evidence presented before me, I can convict this individual. Should we now have a magistrate or a judge who always has to take into consideration that if he's wrong, he is opening the justice system open to a lawsuit? How will that affect his ability to adjudicate the evidence in front of him? So even though, yes, we can be outraged, we can be upset, we also have to look at it from the point of view of the judge, the magistrate, the prosecutor sitting there and saying, I've got this evidence and I want you to make a conclusion, and he must come to a conclusion about it.
So better safe than sorry.
Well, you know, one of the maxims of law is that, you know, it's bad to see a guilty man walk, but it's even more, it's a travesty to see an innocent man rot. So they do try to avoid a conviction where they are not certain and beyond reasonable doubt that this person has in fact committed the crime. But I'm just asking the question that if we have this lawsuit route, for a wrongful conviction, and it's a very easy route to take, will that not have an effect on dispensing justice in the long term?
Well, Law Focus listener, I can tell you that you don't want to miss the next interview that we're going to have, because we're going to pose to our experts who is dealing precisely with these matters whether they believe that suing the state is indeed a good way of dealing with wrongful convictions after this.
Law Focus, point of information.
Welcome back to Law Focus with Millicent and Tepo right here on VAVM 88.2. We are now joined on the line by Simonia Mashangwane, who is project coordinator at the Wits Justice Project, and she's going to give us some very good information about this very issue of wrongful convictions. Welcome to Law Focus, Simonia.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for accepting our request. Let's start with this one. You work at the Wits Justice Project. What do you do, and what is the impact of this very important organization?
So we are a project of the journalism department at Wits. We are an investigative journalism project. So what we do is we investigate cases of wrongful conviction. We actually investigate the criminal justice as a whole. So we look at issues of wrongful convictions, conditions in prisons. We look at remand. So torture in prisons, but we also do investigate wrongful convictions.
Mm.
We have investigated a number of cases over the years.
And when we posed the question to the listener, we asked whether they think that suing the state is a good way of dealing with wrongful convictions. Some said definitely, others were not so sure if that is an effective way. What's your take on this?
I think it's really complicated, and it's a yes and no for me. And I'm going to try and explain why I say so. I think if you can prove that there is a valid case, that you are innocent, which is really, really difficult, I think there you've got a case. But then if we're talking about wrongful convictions in broad terms, then it's going to be really difficult for the state to be able to manage all of that, isn't it? And sometimes wrongful convictions happen based on a technicality. It doesn't necessarily mean that an individual is innocent.
Mm.
So I think if we go the suing route all the time, then we'll have a problem on our hands, because then every person that has been technically been wrongfully convicted and has been exonerated can sue the state to say that I've been exonerated by a court of law. But I think if the individual there is evidence to prove that the person is innocent and they shouldn't have been in prison in the first place, and then they have a case. Take somebody like Thembekile Mlaotsi, who was able to prove that he was innocent, he didn't commit the crime.
Yeah.
He spent 11 years in prison, he comes out. 11 years is a very long time in prison. Mm. And when you come out, your life is basically, you have to start over, you have to catch up, you have to feed your family. In that case, I can understand. But then there are certain cases that are more complicated than that. So it's a yes or no for me.
And
I think if we can prove innocence, then yeah, I definitely agree that people should be able to sue the state. That people do need to be compensated for spending time in prison for things they didn't do.
Well, while we are on that point, what options then do you believe that people who have been wrongfully convicted do have?
I mean, at the moment, people don't have a lot of options. You come out there, somebody apologizes, but then there isn't any sort of support structure when you don't come out of prison, except from civil society. And I think that's a huge gap that we've been seeing. And I think that we're putting people out into the world, maybe still after spending 10, 11, 12, 15 years in prison, into a world that has virtually changed. And there isn't any support to introduce that person into the world to try and get them employment. And so without those kinds of reintroduction mechanisms, we've got a problem. There isn't any financial support. And if somebody comes out, and, you know, the stigma of having been in prison, whether you're guilty or innocent, remains with you. And sometimes people lose their families, and there isn't any support, so they come out of there, and you have nowhere to go. So I think that there should be some sort of financial support. There should be some sort of support, emotional support, psychological support. There's a lot of support that's needed when somebody comes out of prison.
Absolutely.
And I think that's where the major gap is in terms of provision of support for people coming out of prison.
I've got two questions for you. The first one is to do with, say, the judge or the magistrate. I put it out to our listeners, but perhaps I'll put it to you as well, that if, let's say, we open the door to litigation where there's been a wrongful conviction, you know there are a few role players in a conviction. It's the prosecution, the bench, as well as now the defense, and all of those in concert, something has gone wrong and someone is convicted of something they didn't commit. If the magistrate has to take that into consideration whenever he has not a big doubt but even a niggling doubt about his conviction, you know, he can only convict beyond reasonable doubt, but let's say he has got that smidgen of like, I just don't know. Wouldn't it now affect the way in which he adjudicates a matter if he knows that, well, this could lead to a lawsuit constantly?
Yeah, but isn't it that it shouldn't be the case? Where you, that's the very same point that you made. There's reasonable doubt. If you as a magistrate feel that maybe I shouldn't, then that then proves that there is some sort of doubt.
So,
the prosecutors haven't presented the case satisfactorily. You're not convinced that this person is guilty.
Okay.
But then you're still convicting.
Okay.
So in that case, in my personal opinion, I believe that if magistrates feel that, then you shouldn't convict. You should rather ask for more evidence, I think.
Right, okay. Or acquit, if the case is close.
Or acquit, yeah, or acquit. If there's doubt, then maybe let's not put people in prison.
And then let's assume, because we know it's very difficult to sue the state for a wrongful conviction, but let's assume
it's really hard.
Let's assume we have a dispensation that is, we fight for a dispensation that says, but people who are wrongly convicted should get something. We can't just throw them out onto the street after years and years in jail. How would we value it, you know, the time that they've spent in jail? I'm just asking for a suggestion perhaps from you. Is it based on what qualifications they had prior to that? Is it should be more of a standard thing to say, but everybody's time is the same value? Or I could have been a doctor, or I could have been a plumber, or I could have been a security guard in this time, and therefore I should get this amount. What do you think would be a more fair way of doing it if such a dispensation were to exist?
I think it should be on a case-by-case basis.
Right,
that's
okay.
The only way that it would be fair, and everybody would have to state their case. Okay. I think it would be unfair to have a blanket approach to say if you've been convicted and this is how much we'd give you for each year that you've spent in prison, because we don't know what that means for each individual person. So I think then it's important for everybody to be able to state their case. So it should be dealt with on a case-by-case basis.
Mm. And your organization?
I don't see any other option where it could be a fair application of that sort of system.
Okay. I was going to say that your organization, Simonia, has previously made submissions to Parliamentary Portfolio Committee on Justice and Correctional Services about some of these matters, such as this one that we are talking about tonight. What else can we expect from you as a team in handling this matter going further? What are the changes that you are hoping that we will be seeing in the near future?
So, I mean, what we are hoping for right now is that wrongful convictions, as you may have heard tonight, happen for a large amount of reasons. Something gets broken within the entire criminal justice chain, which could lead to a wrongful conviction. But I think one of the biggest issues we have is that we do not have information. The NPA and the Department of Justice, they don't maintain records of wrongful convictions or of people who've been exonerated. So when we don't have information and we don't know the scale of a problem, we can't solve that problem. But we do know that there's a problem. And I think where we need to start now is to gather information, gather data, and know what the extent of the problem is, and to know which areas are problematic, what types of crimes are more prone to, in which crime areas do we see a lot of wrongful convictions happening. So what we've been trying to do is following the US-based model where they have something called a National Register of Exonerations. So in this registry, every exoneration that has been that takes place in the US is recorded in this registry. It's an online database that's accessible by anyone. So what we're trying to do now is the same thing. We're trying to replicate that model where we look for all these cases that convictions that have been overturned, and we put them in a registry. So that way then we can have a place where we can say, well, here's the scientific data. Between 1990 and 2019, there has been this number of exonerations in South Africa. And these are the individuals who've been exonerated. This is the number of years that they spent in prison. These are the judges that convicted and magistrates that convicted them. Mm-hmm. And it is for these crimes. So once we can have that scientific outlook, we'll be able to actually look at where the problem actually lies within the criminal justice chain, and then we'll be able to deal with it. But at the moment, we don't have that information. As the NPA doesn't have it, the Department of Justice doesn't have it, and that's where the big gap is. So we're trying to fill that gap at the moment. It's a long project. It's a big project. We've only just started in the middle of last year, so that's what we're busy working on now.
Right, okay. I'm going to ask you perhaps a somewhat controversial question, but I'd like you to answer it in your opinion and as honestly as you can.
Uh-huh.
In your experience, who's more vulnerable to a wrongful conviction? Is it socially? Is it racial? Is it economic circumstances that exposes someone to being are the victims of this travesty more likely, for example, to be black? Are they more likely to be white? Are they more likely to be male or female? Are they more likely to be younger or older? In your experience, who's the most vulnerable to this?
Black males. Also, it's economic as well. Because if you don't have money, you don't have access to good legal, not good, but you don't have access to the best legal representation.
Mm.
So a lot of things, you don't have access to information, so you're not even able to state your own case. Sometimes people don't even know what's happening, and next thing you know, you've been charged and you've been convicted without even understanding what's happening to you.
Mm.
So it's a lack of information. So things like poverty, young black males, because at that point, it's a combination of socioeconomic factors.
Mm.
But all the cases that we've dealt with have been of males, black and young.
And male?
mostly were young, male and black.
And are there matters that you simply won't take?
What's that?
Are there any matters that you just say, no, go away, we can't help you on this? A matter that you just
There has been a lot where obviously we're a very small team, and we are a donor-funded organization, but we try very, 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 we try as much as possible to ensure that every request that we receive that we investigate thoroughly. But then there are cases where if there's no new evidence, if there is no case, we really can't investigate because it takes a lot of resources for us to do that. So there has been cases that we have turned down, unfortunately, but we don't just look at somebody's letter and say, actually, no, this is actually not going to investigate.
Oh, right, okay.
We really communicate with every individual.
Okay.
We try our very best to respond to every request and ensure that we have an understanding. We do have lawyers that assist us.
Okay.
So even because we're journalists, we're not lawyers. So
yes.
We don't even claim to be experts in the field, so we try and get lawyers to assist us in trying to ensure that we're not missing anything that could be important.
Right. Now, in your investigations and so on, because you have to do a lot of digging in this type of matter, do you find that the information is readily available to you from the courts, from the defense attorney, from the NPA, from whoever it is, iAfrica, whoever it is that now keeps these things? Are those readily available to you, or do you get pushback, or is finances a factor in trying to get this information?
Information is not always readily available.
Okay.
The person who is looking for assistance or whichever case they're investigating, if their lawyer has all that information, it's sometimes helpful. Or if they have their own records sometimes. But half the time, people don't have those. People don't have their own transcripts and they have to pay for them. Getting the information to us, because remember, we're communicating with somebody who's most often than not in prison.
Yes.
So we rely on letters. So, and then we have to go and find this. It's not always readily available. It's hard getting the information. It's hard accessing the individuals themselves. So, and sometimes, yes, there is a little bit of pushback. The biggest problem is people getting hold of their own transcripts.
Mm.
Mm.
Because you can't appeal without having that document. So the biggest problem is people accessing transcripts.
Mm. Well, Simonia, we do have to wrap up our conversation with you. But finally, do you take walk-ins from the public who need any help? Is the information that you're able to give in case any people want to get hold of the Viz Justice Project for any further assistance?
We try not to because we're such a small team. But we are accessible on social media, on the phone, on our emails, via our website. Most people write to us. The old-fashioned ways, letters.
Okay.
I could give you that private bag X-ray, Fed University. And then our phone number is 011-717-4253.
So
and our website is 717-4253. And our website is justiceproject.co.za. And we have the Justice Project on social media.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for joining us on the line. There was Simonia Mashangwani from the Viz Justice Project sharing with us her experience on working with wrongful convictions. Thank you very much.
Bringing you the facts, handing you your rights. This is Law Focus.
So, listener, please, you are welcome to join the conversation by tweeting us on @VowFM using the hashtag Law Focus. Black, poor, young males are the most vulnerable to wrongful convictions.
Yeah, they are. I suppose it's a combination of factors. And it's sad to see that. And hopefully, you know, we can have more work and by the Vitz Justice Project and more support to them to be able to get to the bottom of these sorts of incidents that do occur from time to time.
Absolutely. I think what touched me the most, however, was the fact that when you leave the prison, the jail, after you spend, whether it's 38 years of your life that has been wasted for something that you did not do, there is zero support system. Emotionally, financially, no one's going to help you to try and find a job. It's like no one cares, you know? And it's probably not because the state is just arrogant. I mean, there are resources that are in place. Perhaps our thinking about it has not been enough to try and cover the gap as well. But I think that's the most tragic part about this whole conversation of a young person who goes to jail and leaves maybe a little bit older, and voila, your life has changed, your family, people have died, but there's no counseling, nothing.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter how long you... I mean, it matters, but regardless of how long you've been in prison, having been in prison for something that you should never have been in prison for will totally change your life. It'll go on a completely different trajectory. And one would have expected that that the justice system would make some provision, you know, money aside, but some provision for reintegration of these individuals into society again. So they've been away for 5 years. Things have happened. Things have changed. They've experienced things in prison which we would never want to experience. And then we let them back into society with all that pent-up rage, all that pent-up anger. And it can only have negative consequences. Someone really has to do something about support for people who are acquitted eventually of a crime which they've been sitting in jail for an extended period of time. Remember, some people will be convicted and on appeal they'll be acquitted, but they'll be acquitted sometime, maybe a year, maybe more after their conviction, and they could be languishing in jail for that entire period. Hey?
Absolutely. I mean, you are more than welcome to continue the conversation even when we are not online anymore, when we leave the studio. Let's talk about this. Let's see how we can also try and bring solutions as young people to some of these conversations. They affect us sometimes directly, sometimes indirectly. It might not be you. It might be your friend. It might be an uncle. It might be someone whom you know in close proximity, or maybe even not, who has suffered or might suffer such a tragedy. Let's see what ideas we can come up with. They said they don't have finances. They need donors. They need, you know, maybe someone might see an opportunity for another NGO here.
Perhaps, yeah.
Let's try. I'm just like saying, let's see what we can do. Let's play our role in trying to put systems in place that are going to bring solutions, as opposed to us just talking about the problems but not trying to find ways of dealing with it.
I have a great deal of respect for the individuals that work at Legal Aid. However, they are inundated with work. And there are systems in place to divide those files up to private attorneys who can take on fewer cases and spend more time on each case. I think that's something as well that I think plays a role in convictions of individuals who shouldn't be convicted. And I mean, I don't want to cast aspersions on the Department of Justice, but it is unacceptable that a legal aid attorney has to deal with 20 matters in one day in one court. I mean, nobody is capable of giving the due attention to each of those matters when they are at court. I mean, and there's already a system that exists to divide those up into the private sector at a nominal. It doesn't cost the state very much to do that. It would probably cost them less to do that than to deal with a lot of the repercussions of having people in jail, having matters delayed and all of that. It would probably cost them less just to spread out the files a little bit more. So we really need to, I think, be quite frank about that, that on that part, it's not the individuals at Legal Aid, but I mean, we do have a problem with the manner in which our public defenders are just inundated with work.
For our podcast, including this one that we're talking about tonight, you can go to iono.fm for to check out and review some of the conversations that we have had with you on this show called Law Focus. We'd like to thank our guests who joined us this evening, Mr. Innocent Mthembu from Legal Aid, as well as Simonia Mashangwane from the Bits Justice Project. Remember, you can Google the Bits Justice Project for more information if you would like their help. Otherwise, 011-717-4253 is the number that you can dial to get further assistance from them. They were excellent, and we'd like to thank them so much for joining us on the show this evening. Up next is the Total Package with DLXL. Do stay tuned for that. But for now, from our producer, Simba Honde, our technical producer, Kutano Sirame, our Law Focus researchers, Sisetu Zingelwa, and now Kamamate, Khalaletsang, Khami, Sipati, Makafani, Tapo Muhapi, and myself, of course, Melissa Ntindiweni. Thank you for tuning into Law Focus tonight. Good night.
Good night.
Law Focus on Zolfan 88.1. Point of information.
Law Focus Podcast.